HW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations with Jeff Stein and Gene Meserve.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein. Welcome to another episode of Spy Talk.
And I'm Gene Meserve. Great to have you with us. Have to say, I have done a lot of interviews over the years, but this one has to be one of my favorites. Who are you?
So Gene, my name is Bond, James Bond. I'm the original.
Yes, James Bond. And you thought he was just a figment of Ian Fleming's imagination. There is more to it. Stay tuned. I will explain later.
Speaking of spies in the Cold War, this week I talked with Audra Wolfe, who is a recognized expert in the role of science in the Cold War. She's the author of two books, Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science, and Competing with the Soviets, Science, Technology, and the State in Cold War America. That was a time when science held a special place in maintaining and projecting state power. This week, I asked her whether the American advances in coronavirus vaccines were playing a role in the so-called psychological warfare or soft power competition between the U.S., Russia, and China. Audra Wolfe, welcome to Spy Talk. In your book, Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science, you describe something called Project Troy, how scientists help refine Cold War psychological warfare. Talk to us about that.
Sure. Well, in the late 1940s and early 1950s, the United States was trying to figure out how you could go about carrying out psychological warfare campaigns during a time that was officially not war. Because both the United States and the Soviet Union had atomic weapons, they wanted to avoid the possibility of a hot conflict. And so both countries were very invested in thinking about how to use propaganda, paramilitary operations, various kinds of psychological warfare, economic warfare, to change world opinion, particularly in communist nations.
And scientists seem to have been an afterthought in the psychological warfare competition between the USSR and the US, right?
A little bit. It's interesting that the whole reason they were involved in Project Troy was that the Soviet Union had started jamming the United States radio towers. So scientists were first brought into this large-scale study to think about psychological warfare really as scientists to solve a technological problem. How could you work around this jamming technology? But some of them had expertise in social science techniques, and so they turned their attention to things like, how could the United States exploit Stalin's death when it inevitably happened? How could the United States think about kind of gumming up the bureaucratic works in the Soviet Union? Basically, what kinds of things could the United States do to change world opinion? Everything from dropping pamphlets from weather balloons to doing more radio broadcasts to, again, just kind of gumming up the works by spreading things that might or might not be true.
Right. Yeah, there was a program at the CIA that was dubbed the Mighty Wurlitzer, which was, just churned out all sorts of fake news and propaganda, black propaganda, gray propaganda, in this war of words with the Soviets. But let's talk about some of these programs. Were they successful in defeating the Soviet jamming program? To the Soviets, I should explain, were trying to block broadcasts of the Voice of America into the Soviet Union. Were our scientists successful in defeating the Soviet jamming?
Yes and no. I mean, through building other kinds of towers and placing them. But I think most people who study this period think that the success or not of these programs is immeasurably hard to evaluate. You know, how would you figure out whether campaigns changed hearts or minds? They seem to have been most effective in some ways in appealing to non-communists on the left, so people who were former communists who had turned against Stalin, who wanted to lay out some kind of middle ground that wasn't communism, that wasn't necessarily capitalism. So many of the people involved in these projects were intellectuals and technocrats who were appealing to kind of their peers in places like Western Europe.
Yeah, I want to get back to audiences that this was directed at in a moment. But let's talk about this other scheme to float balloons over China with anti-communist propaganda. That sounds like a bit of a harebrained scheme. Were scientists involved in that?
They were. Many theories of some of the central theories of communication theory about reception and how ideas spread through a population actually came from these. You know, particularly in Asia, the Americans faced a different problem than they faced in Europe. Fewer people had radios. Their attempts to work with private citizens to broadcast weren't working as well, just because there were fewer people with receiving kits who could hear the broadcast. So when the conflict with Korea started, the United States was really struggling to try and figure out how would you reach various populations in Asia. And one possibility was to drop leaflets from the air.
Do we have any idea how effective that was?
I don't think we have any idea on effectiveness. We can say something about quantity, which was that hundreds of thousands of pamphlets were dropped over various periods of time. So this was a large operation. Whether or not it was effective, I think, is an open question.
As far as we know, there might have been use of toilet paper, which, you know, was a recurring theme in World War II movies, you know, of GIs taking German propaganda leaflets and using them for toilet paper. But moving along, you also write in an excerpt in the Atlantic magazine, over time, the CIA and the State Department would find ways to incorporate messages about scientific progress more directly into their work. They did so particularly with programming aimed at a particular class of elite technocrats in developing nations, the very people that the National Security Council proposed to win over in the first place. So these messages were designed for people sort of on the fence in the what we used to call the third world, or and in Europe, or what?
Yes, a lot of the messages aimed at technocrats were specifically aimed at people in what we then call the third world or developing areas, or they might have called themselves in the non-aligned movement. You know, for many of these newly independent countries, the question was, how do you establish economic independence? So how do you get a kind of economic growth that will allow your residents and citizens to be really, truly free? And so the challenge is that these new leaders in these countries were looking both to the Soviet Union and the United States to say, what can we learn from their economic models? What policies and procedures do these different structures, one capitalist, one communist, have to drive various kinds of progress? And the Soviet Union was very effective at saying, hey, look what we did in Russia. Look what we did in these other Soviet territories to drive progress, to turn this from an industrial land to really a cutting edge technological system. And they were saying that the most effective way to do that was through central planning and through various kinds of communism. Mm-hmm. So looking at that, the United States said, well, no, we have a better solution. It's liberal democracy, and we're going to show you how to do it through our version of science.
Right. And the State Department, as you know, put out a glossy magazine called America, spelled with a K, that was directed at these elites, and it touted American scientific progress. Again, the message was, not too subtly, look at our science, we're really superior in this realm. But that sort of brings us up to the present time. There seems to be a very similar kind of psychological warfare aspect to what's going on in competition around vaccines, for example. China in particular sort of waging the soft power war to say, and Russia as well, saying, look, our system, state-controlled capitalism, is better than a sloppy Western democracies at getting things done. Does that play out in this competition over vaccines? Is that a psychological warfare front?
I don't know that I would go so far as to call it psychological warfare, but it certainly does feel like good old-fashioned public diplomacy. As I'm speaking to you today, we've just heard an announcement that G7 is committing to distributing 1 billion doses of vaccine. This seems to be a pretty clear message that these countries are trying to show that democratic nations care about other countries and the rest of the world and are there to help.
Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a big public relations, to put it some other way, victory for the West. So far, it looks promising to say, look, hey, you knock our democracies, but we're going to deliver vaccines and you guys can't. And that seems to be an effective wedge issue for the hearts and minds of Europeans and others who are looking for help. If Washington comes out ahead in that battle, all the better. Do we see scientists playing a continuing role in psychological warfare in the way it was during the Cold War in the 1950s?
It's not clear that we see that now. We certainly saw it during the Obama years. In the decade after the global war on terror, the Obama administration was really trying to use ideas about science and scientific freedom as really an olive branch to what the administration called the Muslim world, sending out scientific envoys. And later we saw this too with the Iran nuclear deal. There was a, in the State Department's publicity associated with that deal, there was a lot of emphasis on kind of scientist to scientist diplomacy between the State Department and their counterparts, between the Department of Energy and their counterparts in Iran. Biden is kind of toying with that, thinking about how we can, you know, reinvigorate science diplomacy after 4 years where I would say it was not a particularly high priority.
Mm-hmm. In the scientific realm and covert action or intelligence gathering, the CIA would certainly see this as an opportunity to cultivate Iranian scientists, Chinese scientists, Russians, and so on through these informal meetings or formal meetings, scientific conferences, and so on. That's always been a playing ground for espionage services the world over. So we can expect the CIA to, as well as Iranian intelligence. It's hard to see an Iranian intelligence officer recruiting an American scientist. However, as we reported yesterday, looking at all the files the Chinese have stolen, federal personnel files, Equifax files, and so on, they have a lot of information that they can leverage. They know if a senior intelligence officer or a scientist connected to the defense industry has money problems or other problems in which they can leverage into recruiting or coercing or blackmailing one of our scientists or officials into spying for them.
That is absolutely true, but it is also true that, as you well know, a lot of what we think of as intelligence and scientific intelligence is actually open information. And it's the kind of information that is best gathered, ironically, through some of the values of science, right? So if you are encouraging scientists to go out on the international stage and mingle with each other, these ideas that science has no borders, that's actually one of the best ways to gather information about, say, what a country's research strengths are, who are the people in that country who might be more sympathetic to your own country's goals, who are your likely allies, where are their weak spots. So yes, when we have, when we set up opportunities for scientists to meet and mingle, we are creating opportunities for intelligence gathering, but we're also allowing kind of science to progress. And it's in scientific intelligence in particular, it's really hard to figure out where that line is between true secrets and just things that would be useful to know about mm-hmm. another country's scientific strengths.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And I think the intelligence establishment can kind of get carried away about clandestine operations, covert action, and so on, to the detriment of gathering open information, which is valuable, very valuable. The Chinese have become their strategy of gathering massive amounts of open information and analyzing it back home has been very successful by most accounts. So one last thing I wanted to get back to, this whole controversy over the Wuhan lab leak and so on. Do you detect some kind of psychological warfare or special interest activity, political activity to put a blemish on China in general and its scientific standards in particular in regard to whether the Wuhan lab was responsible for leaking the coronavirus?
I think that those of us who write and talk about such things are struggling to find the words to describe the political controversy that's happening in Wuhan. Because on the one hand, we see some measures that look like misinformation and disinformation that we might classically think of as psychological warfare.
For example,
rumors spreading through social media that their original attribution is very difficult to trace. The powers of rumor, the power of repetition, the power of asking questions that aren't quite untrue, but imply answers that aren't really there. But that language of psychological warfare generally has been used to apply to external enemies. And a lot of the language that we're seeing about a possible lab leak in the United States very much seems aimed at a domestic audience. It's about whipping up fear of China. It's about kind of bolstering support for the former president's base. It's doing something different. I think it would have repercussions on the international stage if it proved to be true, but I want to reiterate that it's unlikely to be true. The bigger point seems to be to generate doubt and to cultivate doubt in scientific institutions and public authorities more generally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and American institutions as well. You probably saw the viral video of the woman talking about, you know, the vaccinations, you know, making, turning people into magnets and, you know, your car keys stick to your forehead and so on. Do you think American scientists and Western scientists in general are doing an adequate job of contradicting these bizarre attacks on vaccinations?
I think American scientists could do a better job about that. But on the one hand, it's not really their job to do it. I think one of the biggest changes that we haven't fully grappled with is the decline of science journalism in this country. A decade ago, most major papers still had kind of science divisions, science reporters, science beats. And there's less of that now. There are fewer skilled journalists and public communicators who know how to talk to the public in responsible ways about the kinds of uncertainty and doubt that are really built into science, even when it's happening the right way.
Mm, yeah, and this is a global problem now with vaccination resistance. So, Audra Wolf, it's just a pleasure to talk to you. You're doing some fascinating work, and thank you much for coming on Spy Talk to talk about it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, that was a fascinating aspect of Cold War competition, but wait until you hear what Jean's got. She's going to talk to a famous spy. Or is she?
I read the James Bond books when I was a kid. I have seen the James Bond movies, and now I can say I've met the man. Who are you?
So, Jean, my name is Bond, James Bond. I'm the original. And I can see from here a photo of Sean Connery where he signed it for me to James Bond from Sean Connery, the original. And I'm very upset about that because I'm the original.
Are you a British secret intelligence agent?
Well, I'm neither British and the secret intelligence agent. I would tell you, but I'd have to kill you. So.
I was going to say, what do you do? And is it really just an undercover ruse that you're putting out there?
No. Actually, James Bond's a very common name. And I have had a much more prosaic career in industry and in economic development.
So Ian Fleming said that James Bond was the dullest name I ever heard, and that's why he gave it to the character. For you, has it been dull having this name?
You know, actually, I kind of agree with him that James Bond is a pretty dull name, except for me, it's been fantastic. What an icebreaker, what a wonderful way to meet people, to make people happy. You can sort of, you don't leave anyone unaffected. Now, of course, the problem is I actually don't remember names very well, and no one ever forgets my name. So that's a bit of a problem, as you can imagine. But
what are some of the benefits, besides making people smile, of having a name like James Bond.
So let me tell you an anecdote. In my beginning of my career, after studying, getting a couple of degrees, I went off and I worked for an oil company in Paris. I was in Paris. In those days, you know, when you work for an oil company, there were no things like annual performance evaluations and 360 reviews and everything we have now. And if they liked what you did, they gave you an increase at the end of the year. If they didn't like what you did, they fired you. So the feedback was pretty direct. And after I'd been working there probably for about 5 years, my boss, who was called Mr. Carrier, and he used to refer to me as Bond, not James Bond or Mr. Bond, but Bond. And he saw me in the corridor and he said, Bond, I've been thinking, and you know, you're going to have an interesting career. I'm convinced. I'm sure you'll have an interesting career. So I said, the first feedback I'd had in my, you know, in this job that I'd been in for 4 or 5 years, I said, Monsieur Carrier, that's so kind. It's very kind of you. Thank you. I'm very touched. He said, no. It's not that you're competent or anything, but with a name like James Bond, you're sure to have an interesting career. And, you know, he was dead right. It's been a very interesting career.
Has it had some real benefits professionally?
Well, I did have an office that was U12 007. So I got the 007 office running MIGA. MIGA's a piece of the World Bank, kind of a specialized boutique agency. And I had the office 007 on the 12th floor. And when we'd have clients come by, they'd always want to pose with me next to the number, the big number that had James Bond, Chief Operating Officer, U12 007. It was wonderful.
My guess is that people have probably given you gifts over the years that relate to spying or James Bond or 007.
Yes, obviously they do. It's kind of always a joke, kind of a tongue-in-cheek joke. Of course, it's more a joke for them because the first time than for me, well, it's the 50th time. But, you know, it's done in good humor. And what I love is when I go into a cafe or go into some, wherever it may be, I pay with my credit card and they look at my credit card and they go, oh, James Bond, how is it? But what I love is when they pick up something from the books or the films like, shaken, not stirred, huh? I say, A man of culture.
Do you drink martinis, by the way?
I do. Well, not anymore. Not as many as I used to, but a good, you know, James Bond Vespa martinis are a wondrous thing. It's a very good thing.
And do you prefer them shaken, not stirred?
Of course. Naturally.
Are there other aspects of his persona that you kind of incorporated?
Yeah, I'm quite unlike him because he's a kind of a charming thug. And I'm not as charming as him, and I'm definitely not a thug. But, you know, he likes good cars, and I would love to have the money to be able to buy myself an Aston Martin. Unfortunately, I can't. He's a womanizer. I don't think I'm a womanizer. I've been happily married these 45 years, and I have 2 daughters and 4 granddaughters, so I'm surrounded by women. And that's about as much female adulation as I need. But I think he's an interesting character. I mean, he was originally quite dark in the Sean Connery books. Unfortunately, the films have taken this and kind of spun this very glamorous, you know, womanizer, drinker, completely politically incorrect today, but still a very interesting person. But in the books, he was a real thug.
He's also a daredevil. Are you?
Yes. Let me tell you, so when I was, I don't know if you know where Kazakhstan is, but I'm sure the people who listen to this podcast.
I certainly do.
Because they, and so when the Soviet Union collapsed, they sent teams out from the World Bank to join up to see if we could get the different members, Russia and the other stands, the other republics, to join the World Bank, which is a development agency based here in Washington. And so they looked around and they said, we need somebody who understands oil. Bond has spent 10 years in an oil company. He'll go, and we'll send him to Kazakhstan, which had the biggest oil field, Tengiz, in the world. So they sent me off there with a team, people from the IMF and the World Bank and myself. And we arrived in Almaty. It was called Almaty at the time. There was no border. We got off a plane from Moscow. There was no taxis. They didn't have taxis because taxis are bourgeois. So difficult getting up to the Dostik Hotel. And then I sat for about, a week trying to get a meeting with the Minister of Finance, trying to get a meeting and talking to the secretary. By then I had an interpreter. I need to see it. We're from the World Bank, really important. Oh, he saw Bank of America yesterday. No, this is World Bank. Eventually, after a week, I get a meeting and I go in and I've got a full speech prepared for him. And I've got my interpreter and I start off and I say, dear Mr. Minister, thank you very much for seeing me. My name is James Bond and I'm with the World Bank in Washington. The World Bank is a global cooperative owned by 196 countries worldwide. And I go through all of this and I kind of make my spiel. I'm in my dark blue suit and so on. And then Lilia Petrovna, the interpreter, picks up and she says, I don't speak Russian, but I could hear Shmerzny Bank, which was World Bank in Russian. And this guy is sitting, the Minister of Finance, he's kind of like a Russian statue out of granite. He with medals on his chest and very square and behind his big desk, which is on a platform. So we're tiny, much below it. And after listening to her spiel in Russian, he looks at me and he says, in English, if they're sending us James Bond from Washington, Kazakhstan must be in real trouble, he said. And I realized I'd come across the usual problem is that no one takes me seriously with a name like James Bond. But, they did become members shortly after that, so it must have had some kind of an effect on him.
Does it ever become irritating?
Well, sometimes when people belabor the point, as though it's the first time, when people know that I've probably heard it before, and they do it with a bit of tongue-in-cheek, but sometimes people will do it like it's the first time anyone's ever done it to me, and of course it isn't. It's probably not even the first time that particular day, so I'm quite used to it. But as I said, I love the people who throw in an Aston Martin or a Shaker Not Stirred or whatever it might be. Miss Moneypenny. A friend of mine invited me to lunch in France and he had the lunch because he had invited Dr. No. And so James Bond and Dr. No. And we had this great lunch and had I don't know how many bottles of wine. He was actually a medical doctor from Paris. He was of Vietnamese origin. So he was spelled GNO, but it's pronounced Dr. No. So I had that. And then I also once was trying to interview a guy that we wanted to hire as a consultant on something very, very arcane about financial markets or something. And all of the members from the hotel, this is the Amitié Hotel in Brussels for those, L'Hôtel de l'Amitié in Brussels for those who know it. And all of the staff kept kind of wandering, hovering around us, couldn't understand. And then I realized that actually potential consultant's name was Goldfinger. And they were all wanting to see James Bond having breakfast with Goldfinger.
Are there certain perks to it? Is it easier to get a restaurant reservation or?
None. Well, let me tell you, a restaurant. So you go to the restaurant, you go up and you say, hi, I have a reservation for 8 for 2. And they say, yes, sir. What is the name, please? And they look at the list. And I say, James Bond. They say, oh, we thought you were a joke. They said, and my wife said, they were right. So then they have to scramble because they didn't reserve me a table. And actually, when I was at university, I can remember that you'd have to sign up for these, technical workshops and so on. And of course, you put your name down for which slot you wanted. And then they would go through and they'd take out all the Count Draculas and Mickey Mouses and things like that. So I always got scrubbed because I was in the same category as Count Dracula and Mickey Mouse. And they just took me off the list.
Do you have a favorite book or a favorite amongst the movies?
I actually like the Sean Connery ones a lot. I thought From Russia with Love had the right mix. But I must say some of the more recent Daniel Craig movies have been pretty good too. But he is a bit politically incorrect. I think it's gotten a little bit better.
Oh, incredibly incorrect back at the Sean Connery movies.
At the old ones. But I think it's got much better now. The kind of women have actual real roles. They're not just bimbos and sort of there for the eye candy, as it were, which is it's a little bit off-putting now when you go back and watch some of those movies.
So the first book came out in 1953. I've not been indelicate enough to ask when you were born.
I predate the book.
Parents had absolutely no idea that they were naming you after the most famous fictional spy in history.
Well, he wasn't then. And you can imagine my teenage years when you're all very timid and you're growing up and all of a sudden James Bond is a thing, so it made my teenage years very interesting.
Did your parents ever have any remorse for having given you this name?
None. And my son, who has three little girls, absolutely wanted to call one of them James Bond. And he obviously has three. So the third is called Juliet James Bond, JJ, Juliet James Bond. So the name James Bond has now not only been retained in the family, but has actually switched genders, which I think is very appropriate.
So overall, would you say it's been a blessing or a curse?
Definitely a blessing. My parents didn't leave me much, but they left me that, and I get as much out of it as I can.
By the way, he says that one of the toughest things about having the name James Bond is trying to claim an email account. A lot of people want to use the name, even if it is not the name on their birth certificate. He also says it's humbling to do an online search. He shows up on about page 15 of the Google search results.
Could be worse. Imagine if your name was Lex Luthor.
Nope, wouldn't want that one. Thank you very much. I do have a name, though, and it's Jean Meserve, and I'd like to say thank you to all of us for joining us and to remind you to subscribe to Spy Talk on Substack.
And I'm Jeff Stein. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Spy Talk podcast. See you next week.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.